What's in the post today? I had to seek professional advice on one of these. If the Buddha had heard a Bach cello concerto, do you think he might have been tempted to say that not all things are uncertain? If the Buddha had heard a Bach cello concerto, do you think that he might have been tempted to say that not all things are uncertain? They're all fabrications. I've been sought professional opinion from both a Buddha and a musician. Subtle and refined fabrications, but still fabrications. But something about effort and how to play with that, how to work with that. There used to be a fashion for many years, some of you go back many years in this, will have heard talks about the paramitas. And they feature in a great chunk of Buddhist literature, which is not actually part of the canon, called the Jataka stories. Well, a lump of stories, which are stories that grandmothers and mothers tell their children, and monks tell people to frighten them, inspire them. They're all the sort of, I think there are about 570 of them. Just all stories about previous lives of the Buddha. That's what they're called, previous lives of the Buddha. They don't form part of the Pali canon, so you don't have to believe a word of them. They're fun. And they're all about the qualities that were needed in order for the Lord Buddha to actually... you know, for the birth, the last birth, before the last birth of the Bodhisattva, the Bodhisatta, the last birth of Siddhartha Gautama, all the previous lives from the time that there was the determination to be a Samma Sambuddha. Samma Sambuddha is one that, there are different types of Buddhas, just to be complicated. There are Buddhas that don't teach, but are awake. They're called Pacheka Buddhas. They're Samma Buddhas, who are pretty good, but don't necessarily last very long. And there are Samma Sambuddhas, that whose dispensations last longer and are pretty good. Gautama Buddha was a Samma Sambuddha. He got it all right. And in order to do that, he had to... the commentaries go. It's not actually again in the scriptures, it's a commentary. So that there are 10 things that have to be perfected, had to be made fully developed. And they give an indication because I expect what all of you would really like to experience is the birth of a Buddha, yes? In your lives, in your world, in your universe, you'd like to experience the birth of a Buddha. Yeah, you'd be perfectly taught by somebody who is perfectly capable of teaching all beings, and teaching you in particular. Well, all you have to do is perfect the 10 perfections, and then the Buddha will be born in your world. No, so it's something that you can work with within yourself, I think is how they try to put it. Because in the formula, in the Eightfold Path, right effort, samavayama, or the perfect balance, or the balance, the effort that's in tune, is pretty abstract, really. It's pretty abstract. The first thing of right effort is to notice if there are any unwholesome qualities that are around and in within one's universe, and not add to them. And that's, so if there's anything that one notices that is unwholesome, not add to it. And if there's anything that one notices that is wholesome, then maintain it and develop it. And then if there's anything that one notices that is wholesome that is not around and present in your universe, then to develop that. And then if there's anything that's unwholesome or not around in your universe, don't do that. So that's right effort, Samawayama, Eightfold Path. But it doesn't tell you very much what to do, does it? It doesn't tell you what might be wholesome or what might not be wholesome. It just says that much and leaves the rest up to you. There are commentaries that do say things about what's wholesome and what's unwholesome, and you can read those. But one of the things that used to be very fashionable at Chithurst, I think it's fashionable also in other teachings as well, I think it was fashionable in Oakenholt even, when we used to live there, was this teachings on the 10 paramitas. And the test is always if the person who's speaking about it can actually remember all 10. there's an order as well. So I'm not sure whether I get the order right, but I reckon I can probably figure out the 10. And I really like Ajahn Buddhadasa's comment on these, which was that if you develop one fully, then all the others are necessarily developed fully. You only really have to remember how to develop one, and then you'll get the rest along the way. They'll pick up the rest as you go along. You don't even need to name them. So you'll see how they work. And the traditional one in the list is dana, and you'll notice that I've mentioned that again and again, probably every day. There are a number of Jataka stories about dana, and the one that is remembered and the one that's horrifying for most of us is the last one, which is the Buddha's last, the Bodhisattva's last birth before the birth in the Sita heaven, before the birth as Siddhartha Gautama. And that's the one where he's born into a wonderful royal family as a prince, and Prince Vasantara. And he decides, makes the determination, and we'll come round to determination later, to say whatever is asked of him, that he will give if it's in his power. Yeah? Whatever anybody asks of him, if somebody asks something from him, if it's in his power, he'll give it. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? You know, anyone ask anything of you, and if you can give it, you give it. It starts to get a bit horrifying, actually. And because, of course, being wealthy and rich, of course, people start to get wind of this, and they start asking him for all the money. He gives all the money away, gives all the goods away. I think he probably gets to be king somewhere along the way. He probably becomes to be king. So I think he starts giving away as prince, but he can't give away so much when he's prince. When he becomes king, he can start giving more away. And then so he starts giving away. And then the people and the advisors of the king and the advisors of the kingdom say, enough, enough. You have to go. You're giving too much away. You'll have to leave. And you have to leave with and all you can leave with is your wife and children. Two children? Wife? think it is. I forget this. I don't think it's a long time since I've read this story. Too frightening, really. Then so he goes and walks out with his, I think with a carriage and all that sort of stuff, and goes along, and then what happens is Saka, king of the gods, when anything really important happens in the universe, what happens is Saka, king of the gods, he sits on a throne, and his throne gets warm. So he knows something important is happening. Saka, king of the gods, and that's a position. It's one of the gods that has a position. Saka, king of the gods, a particular Saka, king of the gods. He's probably still around, same one. Gods live a long time. And his throne gets warm, and he thought, well, I'll test this Bodhisattva. Let's see if his determination's really strong. So he goes down and he disguises himself as quite a nasty old man, actually. Yeah. Quite a nasty, perverted old man. So he asks, well, Prince Visanta, and he said, oh, it's very nice. You've got... Will you give me your wife? Is it wife first or is it children first?
Children first.
So ask, will you give me your children? Now, would you give your children to a dirty old man? Prince Visanta says, well, I've made this determination. What am I going to do? Actually, he doesn't hesitate, actually, does he? He doesn't really hesitate. His wife complains. His wife complains. Well, you know, you can always get some more, can't you? But eventually, yes, he gives away his children. And, of course, as he continues on, goes off into the forest, continues on. And Saka says, well, I've probably not done enough. Nice. Then he asks for his wife, doesn't he? Asks for his wife as well. And he gives away everything. Everything. Wife, children, kingdom, the whole thing. Of course, having given everything away, it being Saka that he gave it to, and not really a dirty old man, he gets everything back and the kingdom back, and all lives happily ever after. But it's really quite shocking, and then you think, well, what does that mean? If you look in your own heart and in your own life, are you prepared to give away, you know, all that you've created, all of your kids? Are you prepared to give that all back to nature, all back to, you know, that which is going to go into old age, sickness, death? You're prepared to give away all the possibility of further growth, further companionship, further creation? How desperately do you want this Buddha to be born in your world? No. It's worth considering. No, and I think it's a question of just thinking and saying, well, what, giving completely in each moment, when you're sitting in meditation, when you're being with the sense of knowing. You know, if you really want that sense of knowing to really flower and be full, then the sense of real surrender in each moment, the complete giving up of expectation, of any holding on to the sense of power, kingdom, wealth, possibility, So there's really nothing left, so that the attention is just a complete gift to the moment. So often when we come to our meditation, we really, really want something back from it. You know, we might, well, think that we don't, but, you know, if I just give the right amount of attention here, do you think I can have a little bit less pain in my knees? If I just, you know, there's always some sort of bargaining going on. Anyway, that's, so the first perfection is dana, and one can see that there are others necessary for that to be fully developed. The next one is sila. Sila is important because it allows one to not have to hide from anything or anybody, or have to hide anything. So it's really, so everything can really be revealed. Everything can be opened. There's nothing to feel any sort of sense of, you know, you don't have to put a little bit in a compartment, a little bit away, with the practice of sila. That's its function and joy as a training, and it means that, and if you really perfect your sila, particularly your five precepts, then, and if that's something that you practice well and consistently through your life, then the possibility of a low rebirth, or a rebirth that doesn't, the possibility of other than a human rebirth is very small. Because if that's your intention, it's a really beautiful, you know, if you want to put effort into anything, then put effort into training in the five precepts. I'll speak more about them towards the end of the retreat, about what they mean, each of the precepts. And that's a talk or a consideration in itself. But the basic ones are, you know, training oneself and admitting when there is the impulse to kill anything that breathes, taking responsibility for that. Training oneself not to take that which isn't given, not to steal. Training oneself not to misuse the very powerful energy of sexuality in ways that are just exploitative or dishonest, or or just into power or things like that. Training oneself not to deliberately distort the truth when one speaks or writes or communicates, so one's not knowing that one's going to lie, that one has lied, that one is lying. So that we're training oneself not to deliberately lie, and training oneself not to take any sort of intoxicants or drugs that can lead to carelessness, as a training. They're not enough for enlightenment, but they provide a really, really firm foundation, and they really, one really has to work and perfect them, and again, perfecting them, one perfects the others, because it's one of the most generous things that one can possibly do in this world, is to offer the possibility of somebody who can be trusted. And one can really trust somebody who keeps the five precepts. You know? If people are not keeping the five precepts, it's really difficult to trust them. You know, it's difficult to trust somebody who's driving, who's even just taken a couple of drinks. Yeah? It doesn't take much to go over the limit, does it? Not very much at all. One can feel one's perfectly sober, really, and still be, you know, scientifically proven to be incapable of really of being in charge of something that's dangerous like a motor car. Yeah? Strange, isn't it? The limit doesn't seem to be very much, does it? But then people drive their lives and make decisions that affect their lives and affect other people's lives when they're well over the limit. Yeah? And that's not considered even strange to do things when one's really half cut or three quarter cut or completely cut and then make decisions about one's own lives, about other people's lives. Even it's even praised, you know, you have a nice wet lunch and make a deal that can involve millions of pounds and people's lives. And the people are half drunk, they wouldn't be allowed to drive a car. Drive countries. Strange, isn't it? Never mind. I'm not saying, you know, there's anything, you know, I'm not saying don't ever take a drop of alcohol ever again. Swear off it, it's evil. I'm not saying that. I'm saying really know what you're up to when you're up to it. And admit that you're breaking a precept if you're breaking a precept. Really admit it. So that you've got nothing to hide. You're really clear about what you're up to. And this leads to the next one, which is, I think, renunciation, nekamma. Renunciation is, it's a bad word, isn't it? You don't want to hear that you have to renounce, do you? You really don't. You really want to hear you can have everything. Just give me more and everything. But what one renounces is actually that which is harmful or that which is unnecessary. And what one gains is freedom. The purpose of the renunciation is actually freedom. Yeah? The freedom to actually notice what's going on, free from care and worry. Now, these guys in brown and white, we're professional renunciants. This is our business. quite apart from professional breath watchers, but it's you know, and our intention and our aspiration is freedom. Through the conscious renunciation of what it gives is actually a sense of power and a sense of possibility, and something about sacrifice and how, you know, with sacrifice one actually makes things sacred. The thing is that actually any choice that one makes in life, there has to be some sort of renunciation. Because if you choose one thing, then you give up something else, actually. You can't actually do it all. But the, you know, the guys dressed like this, the professional renunciants, are actually saying, well, we'll renounce that which is actually not absolutely necessary for life. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Money. We're not saying anything more about it, but that's what we're, you know, there's more and there's complicated bits about what we can do when we can do it, but the basic thing is there's the renunciation of that which is unnecessary. And if you've proven to yourselves that at least for a while it's possible to live without a square meal in the evening, without sexual activity, And you haven't had to buy anything here, so you're pretty free from that sort of stuff. You know? So, well, try that 24/7, 365, 10, 15 years. You know, that's the option that's open. it's an option. Certainly not for everybody, and people say, well, what would happen if everybody did it? Fat chance. We'll work that one out if it happens. No. We'll work that one out if it actually happens. But and in that, there needs to be some sort of resolution. Resolution is called aditana. And so aditana is like sort of a decision, and then remembering the decision that one's made. Like the decision to relinquish cigarettes. Do you remember that one, some of you? Some of you, I remember that one. The decision to relinquish smoking cigarettes. There is quite, well, not so often nowadays, but there is occasionally the impulse, and even people do, you know, people offer bhikkhu cigarettes. Could you Adam and Eve it? They do. You know, just see if we can just get them. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, it'd be nice to have a cigarette. And then what I have to remember is that I don't smoke anymore. Now, it's been quite a few years, but I just have to remember at that moment that I don't smoke anymore. And that's all that's necessary with aditana. I don't have to remember it all the time, but I have to remember when the occasion arises that there's the possibility of doing something that I've determined not to do. At that moment, then all I have to do is remember. That's what aditana is about. It's just remembering at the moment of opportunity. Yeah, what the resolution is. What I find, you know, is very burdensome is trying to remember all the time. If I had to remember all the time that I've given up smoking, it would be very burdensome. Very, very burdensome. And I probably wouldn't be able to sustain it at that level. You know, I'd soon think, well, I've given up smoking. All this thinking about I've given up smoking, it just makes me want to smoke the whole time. Because, you know, it's like you've got, you know, it doesn't work like that. You know, if I just remember at the moment when somebody's offering me a cigarette, I don't smoke anymore. Okay, no problem. Yeah, it's much, much lighter. Yeah, you know. Or the determination to do something, okay? Determination. I've determined to learn this chant. Yeah? All I have to do is remember at the opportunity that I've determined to learn the chant. So, pick up the chant and start learning it. If I think now, well, I've determined to learn this chant, I don't know when I'm going to learn this chant, it's going to be a trouble. You know, then I'm making it really difficult for myself. I made a resolution, but I've not really, and I'm not really using it in the right way, you know. Aditana is just momentary thing. If you really get, it's quite easy to misuse aditana. It's quite easy to misuse all of it, but you know, aditana is one of those things that, if you're very strong-willed, resolution can be misused and can make things much too stiff. It's actually quite a light thing and quite a joyous thing. No, it's fun to learn the chant, so I just have to remember to do it. But you need to be honest about it. You need to be honest about it. And satya is really, is, you know, is the next to the paramitas. And there are few people who are really, really, really good with satcha. There's one of the bhikkhus that I know is very good. I won't mention his name, but very, really works well with satcha paramita. And then I met another bhikkhu, 111 years old. He's probably 113 by now, on Phuket Island. And he'd walked to Beijing, walked around all the holy places, walked to Tibet. I don't think he had probably ever had a passport. You know? He did a lot, long ways. He spent some time with Ajahn Chah, little time walking. He said, you know, it was before the days of trucks and buses and aeroplanes. He just walked everywhere. He doesn't hear too well nowadays. So anyway, we went to see him. His emphasis, when he actually did actually emphasize something, he said, really determine and use satcha paramita. Really use honesty, truthfulness. Obviously it'd been something that he'd really worked on, to be really clear about what you're doing it, when you're doing it, how you're doing it. So that sense of honesty about what one's doing as a perfection. No one can, there are even tales of using satcha paramita, you know, that's in the Jatakas or in some of the commentaries of the Dhammapada. You know, there was a couple who wanted, whose child was sick, and they came and asked one of the sages, you know, what should I do about this? You know? And you know, it's the ideas of you know, getting the sage to do some sort of magic. You know, people are always interested in magic, aren't they? Yeah, magic powers. Can you cure this child by your magic powers? And so the story goes that the couple came and asked this sage about how, you know, what should I do in terms of magic? You know, what should I do to cure this child? And he said, well, make a declaration of truth. Make a declaration. Say something that's true. Say something that's absolutely true for you. And by the power of this truth, say, may my child be cured. Okay? That's a way that the power of truth is supposed to have that sort of power. By a declaration of truth is supposed to have the power to shift things and to change things, particularly to cure people. And I think, so the story goes, I think the wife said something like, I've been married to this, my husband, now for 10 years, and there hasn't been one moment that I've had a moment of happiness. I've just hated him the whole time. By the power of this truth, may my child be cured. And of course the child was cured. it doesn't have to be something that's particularly good. At least you know what's going on. Yeah? You know, or I think a bhikkhu was one time made in one of the stories an asseveration of truth and said something like, I've been a bhikkhu for 25 years now and it's been a struggle the whole time. I've not enjoyed one little bit of it. By the power of this truth, may. And of course it worked. So, you know, it's not saying it should be anything, but at least you're clear about what's, you know, you're trying to make it clear about what's happening. Satcha. Dana, sila, nekamma, satcha, aditana, satcha. Virya. Virya is effort. Effort, you know, it comes from that sense of putting forth effort into things, being vigorous, same sort of root. And different from Vayama, Yeah, it's not about right efforts. It's actually just about the oomph, putting the oomph into it. Actually, putting your, you know, and that's actually necessary. You actually have to make an effort to do it. You know, you actually have to put some vigor into what one does. You know, so it's not just, it's not sort of half-hearted or wishy-washy, or just not, you know, without any sort of vigor in it. No, there has to actually be that sort of sense of vigor. Okay, it needs to be balanced by the next one, panya, wisdom. Yeah. So there's a sense of, you know, how much effort here, how much vigor here. Appropriate, you know, you don't put too much effort into things so you break things, but you actually do have to put some effort into it. There does have to be that sort of vigor behind what one does in the spiritual life in order for it to actually bear fruit, in order for it to actually for there to be some beneficial result, in order for there to be something happen. Where have we got to? Kanti's next, you're right. But you have to keep doing it. You have to remember to bear with it. Yeah? Patient endurance is a supreme austerity. Hanti's, well, yeah, it's it comes in the whole range, that sense of, and patience is, again, it's a momentary thing. If you think you have to be patient for a long time, it's impossible. The only time you have to be patient, again, is right now. You have to be able to bear with and be with what is right now. Your patience is for this moment. Again, like Aditana, Aditana is this moment, you have to remember. Patience, again, is for this moment, to actually bear with and be with this moment exactly as it is. If you think I can't bear it for another moment, don't bear it for another moment, bear it for this moment. No, it's the only time that you really need to do it. You know, this is the moment that there's patience. And it's the supreme, the absolute best evaporator of all defilements. Patient endurance is the supreme austerity, the supreme burner away of all defilements. Panti paramang tapo titika, nibbana paramang vadanti buddha. Nibbana is the highest, it's the culmination. The avada parimokkha. Again, in order to, you know, to practice the rest, you need all the barometers to practice one. If you practice one barometer completely, the rest have to come into it. They work in conjunction. The next two are the ones that we've been talking about, the last two, metta and upekkha. Metta, not dwelling in aversion, the first thing. One of the questions here is, what's the difference between metta and karuna? Yeah, explain the difference between metta and compassion and karuna. They seem to share much, and I'm not sure how you can have metta without compassion, or compassion without metta. What is the difference between wishing compassion and wishing yourself compassion and wishing yourself metta? Compassion or karuna is usually actually paired with panya. It's usually actually paired with wisdom. You know, those two are actually the two that actually go more together. Because compassion is doing something that will actually relieve and suffering, relieve pain, relieve discomfort, or something that's not quite right. Yeah. And it's incredibly spacious. You know, the way that they display compassion, they personify compassion, is you have those thousand armed Kuan Yins, yeah, with a different thing in every hand. And the idea is that Kuan Yin has is always willing to give a hand. She's got a lot to give, and she's also got she's always holding lots of different things, because she's more complete than a Swiss Army knife. She has something for everything. Yeah, she has just the right tool for the right job. But actually, all she really does, well, the male form of her is Avalokiteshvara, and all Avalokiteshvara does is actually just listen to the cries of the world. And the rebirth, if there's compassion is developed and nothing more, then no further insight is developed, which is pretty difficult, actually. I mean, if you just develop compassion and don't have any insight at all, then you're actually probably pretty peculiar. But the story is that, or the sutta says that if compassion is developed and there's no other insight, then the rebirth is in the realm of infinite space. In the realm of infinite space. And that gives an idea of the quality of compassion. Compassion is just so spacious, there's space for all the pain of the universe. And where it's possible, it acts through panya. Actually, the active quality, or panya and compassion, they work together. Acts with panya. Metta, on the other hand, is more basic than that, or more simple than that, or more attractive than that in some ways, because metta is just the sense of wishing well. It's not necessarily acting and not dwelling in aversion. You know, even those that are fortunate, one still wishes well. Even those that whatever one meets, one doesn't have to relieve any pain. One's not making any sort of effort to relieve any pain necessarily. One's just completely accepting and not dwelling in any sort of aversion. And it's really, really basic. We'll deal with the other two Brahma Viharas as well, because the next one is Upeka. And one of the teachers talks about the four Brahma Viharas as development stages also for. I think it's Bhante Gunaratana teaches this more, to give him his correct, give the reference for this. But this, in for children, for the growth of a child, the first thing that the child needs to experience is metta, the sense of being completely accepted for exactly how the child is, without any sort of not experiencing any sort of aversion or pushing away. And this is, you know, this for a child is the first thing that they really need to experience. For the child, for the mother, practice of metta is really important, because the initial experience of pregnancy is actually of something foreign being present, something that the body at its first instance would like to push away, because it's some strange DNA that wasn't there before that's then present, and it's got to work out how to deal with it. So it's, and what it needs is a placenta, which gives it some sort of space around it and acts as the sort of filter. But the initial thing that it needs to experience, the child, you know, in order for the child to actually develop, is a sense of acceptance. It's okay, it's safe here, I'm not going to get pushed out. I'm here, I'm right, okay. And so metta is really important for the child. Then the next stage is karuna, yeah? Because then it needs to experience the sense of wishing to relieve whatever pain may be experienced. Yeah? And actually active things that actually do to actually relieve it of any pain. When the nappy's wet, when it needs help. You know, it actually needs to experience karuna in order for it to grow and develop. And then in order for it to continue, then the next thing is a sense of joy and appreciation at its success. At whatever happens that's actually wonderful about it. Oh, it's managed to burp. Fine. It's managed to toddle. It's managed to crawl. You know, so it's experiencing a sense of appreciation and joy at its success. Okay, with luck, it does other things as well. But, you know, so it experiences a sense of mudita, joy and appreciation at goodness or success or whatever. And then finally, what it also needs, and also for the sake of the parent also, is upeka, because it's going to go its own way. It's going to do whatever it does. It has its own life. When you don't know when you're going to have to experience and practice upeka towards it, because it has its own, it belongs to nature, and it's got to be given back to nature. You don't actually own the whole thing. That's a rough outline of how, I think Bhante Gunaratana deals with this. And no, upeka is the quality of the Brahma Viharas that oversees the other three, metta, karuna, mudita, and also accepts limitation. At its basic level, upeka accepts limitation. There's only so much that can be done. Even a Sammasambuddha cannot relieve anybody's suffering. A Sammasambuddha can only set in motion causes and conditions that can allow other beings to relieve their own suffering. There's that limitation. The Sammasambuddha is supremely equanimous and supremely patient and incredibly generous. Now one can see in the story in the life of the Buddha how the 10 perfections were really manifest. And the encouragement, I hope, this is for you to allow the Sammasambuddha to be born in your universe, in your world, so that there's the possibility. What the Sammasambuddha does, he reveals the Dhamma, and he also offers a training. And the training is what sustains the Dhamma over time, the Vinaya and the. So what the Sammasambuddha reveals is the Dhamma Vinaya. He doesn't just reveal the Dhamma, he reveals the Dhamma Vinaya. Actually, in the Tripitaka, the Vinaya is what starts it all, and what sets the whole thing, and keeps the whole thing protected. Which is why there's the importance of the Sangha and the importance of renunciation. So that gives you some idea of what you can do. You can practice the 10 paramitas fully. You've got a few more days. I hope that explains the difference between metta and karuna. How does one know one is practicing rightly beyond views, judgments, good, bad, jhana, or jhana, necessary, unnecessary? Well, if the paramitas and the wholesome qualities are growing in one's life, then one knows one's practicing rightly. Part of that is also, a sense of gratitude. And what I was, one of my first teachers just said, if one's growing in gratitude and humility, then that's a good indication. A story about a dog, which I'll get to. When I meditate for a while, I find my breath disappears and feel that my mind stops. What should I do? Try to find my breath back or try to look at what's happening? Just try to look at what's happening. Just try to notice what's next, that sense of wonder, that sense of wonder in the sense of awe or the sense of, whoa, I wonder what's going to happen next. In that sense, rather than being too, like one's on the top of a roller coaster, one's going to go, wee, see what happens next. Trust that you're being held in by your sila and by the situation. What does compassion mean? I don't understand the English. I think I'm done with that. If I'm going to do... You are going to die. If I'm going to die, should I do meditate anapanasati? You're going to die. Just, I don't know when. And it's okay. Practice anapanasati is good. But don't worry about it. Practice whatever you're practicing, whatever you're familiar with. Anapanasati is great, but whatever you're familiar with, each moment, and practice living with the Buddha. If you practice living with the sense of awareness, it's probably the best being to live with is the Buddha. So do practice with the Buddha right, in your heart, all the time. That's the best, probably. Oh God. Knowing the fact, is it a fact anyway? Knowing the fact that everything is anicca, would it be possible to stop eating? Not only for a certain period of time, but for the rest of our life. Everything subsists on some sort of nourishment. Ahara. Food is part of, exists because everything exists because of some sort of nourishment. And I think that if you don't, to eat wisely, to know what one's taking in, when one's taking in, how one's taking in, and to eat for the benefit of others, to eat for the benefit of this body, which belongs to nature, to take in, digest, to learn. I mean, learning is about eating in some ways, because you take in information and process it produce it again in a different form. what is eating anyway, except for processing energy. This is an energy processor. And to think, I don't need to process any energy. You're going to have to process some sort of energy. It's to be careful about what you process, when you process, how you process. Just believing that you don't have to eat. Somebody's asked me about doing 3-week fasts. There was a time when I used to fast. I've given it up. I just do it every day, between noon and the next dawn. It's good enough. Not to make too much about food. Food is just what it is. Anything that one processes is just what it is. One processes it. Why is he reflecting? I take this in. Why is he reflecting? like, you know, produce it. It's, you know, not to make a mess about it, not to make a problem about it. Where have we got to? This one I find a little bit difficult. To my dog. Animals and merits. Sometime in the evening, when I think I'm too sleepy for meditation, my dog rushes to the mat and looks at me expectantly. He teaches me vigor. When a cat walks by, barks frantically. He teaches me patience. Sometimes, during meditation, he nestles down beside me and falls asleep and starts snoring. He teaches me loving kindness. I dumped him into a dog's pension and went for this retreat. Who is attaining good fortune? Share your merits with your pets. Do share your merits with your pets. We do a chant, one of the chants in here, page something or other. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, I don't know what page it is, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, invisible, or those who are indifferent. Friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. That one, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. Yeah? Include your pets. You know, include the goldfish, the earwigs you keep in the little matchbox that you brought with you. And, you know, because your pets are, you do create connections with them. And because it, and they're on levels that you sometimes don't really know very much about. And do wish them well. Take good care of them. There's certain responsibilities around pets, and people always ask about the question about what happens when the vet says, and you really have to make your decisions at that point, what you're going to do. And you know, people do different things, and I don't encourage people to. It's part of the life of having a pet that you might come to the decision about whether you accept the vet's advice to put it down or what you do with it. And you have to make that decision then. You may not have to make that decision. Maybe something will happen. Maybe it'll get run over. It's really not sure. And for kids, pets are good. They give them the opportunity to do all sorts of things, and they learn to live with separation. You know, I'm not saying don't have pets, I'm not saying do have pets, but if you do have pets, then accept the responsibility that's involved with them. They're not quite like kids, not really. Don't try to teach them, treat them like kids. But if you do have a dog, then the kindest thing you can do with almost any, actually with any pet, if it's possible to train a pet, if it's possible to train a pet, it's difficult with earwigs, but with you know, with dogs, the kindest thing you can do to a dog is to train it very, 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 very well. Sorry, there's a lot of verys in there, but it's important. You know, because if you train your dog well, then when it meets other human beings, other human beings will like it. Yeah? What does your heart do when you see a dog that's been trained to be the eyes of somebody? Yeah? What does your heart do? I know what mine does. Oh, isn't that lovely? Yes? What does your heart do when you see a yappy dog that's making a nuisance of itself? Or just frightening people? Or just not knowing how to behave? You think, gosh, that's a horrible thing. Because that's what my heart does. And whose fault is that? Who's responsible for it? The dog itself can't train itself. The dog itself can't train itself. Train the dog well. Train the dog well. Even if it's a lot of work to train a dog well. It's not something that's done easily. It's not something that's done quickly. It's something that needs to be, a lot of care needs to be taken over it so that one can feel completely at ease around it and other human beings can feel completely at ease. Because then the dog will receive a lot of metta. A lot of sense of, because it won't receive a lot of hostility and anger. Yeah. And they can certainly sense what they receive, animals. So if you do keep a pet, train it well. And then you share the blessings of your life with it, truly. The blessings of the human possibility with it, because human beings are good at, well, if they do it well, they can train themselves. Dogs need to be trained. You know, cats too, if you can. If you can train a cat, you're pretty good. It's possible to a certain extent, but it's has its limitations. And if you keep a monkey, then you really need to train it well. You know, you really need to train monkeys well, or if you keep a lion or something like that. It's a dangerous thing. So, and look after your goldfish.